I'll call the meeting of the House Education Finance Committee to order. And first, I want to just remind folks, it's been hard to hear in this room, so make sure that you use your mics. And then we are going to have, That's okay. We're going to move right away to the approval of the minutes for October. Boy, it is morning, huh? January 10th, Representative Clardy. Have you had a chance to review the minutes?
I have. So moved.
Representative Clardy moves the minutes for January 10th. Any questions on that motion? Seeing none, the minutes are approved. And with that, members, we are going to go back to the wonderful world of education finance and delve into it a little bit deeper. And I am going to kick it off. If you did not put your materials in the save packet, let us know so we can get them to you again. Don't want you to miss anything. And otherwise, we are going to move over to Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. Tim Strom from House Research. Ms. Beckel and I are going to finish, hopefully within a half hour. We'd like to leave a little bit of time for questions. We know you have a full presentation from MDE afterwards. And there's just three topics we want to cover real quickly with you this morning. And as we said yesterday, we're happy, the three of us individually, to answer any questions that you might have, either in the committee setting or offline, whatever works for you. Happy to provide you whatever additional information on school finance that you need. Madam Chair, members, the three things we want to talk today about are where the budget narratives are and what they show, about pupil trends, since funding is based on the pupil count. We want to spend just a minute on that. And then we wanted to finish up the discussion that Representative West started yesterday on property taxes. There's a few things we want this committee to be aware of for that. In terms of the budget narrative, MDE can speak to this as well. But what happens is each agency prepares a detailed analysis of each area of funding, and that's posted on the Management and Budgets website. So MMB's website has the budget narrative. The governor's recommendations about how additional spending over base will be included in 2 weeks when that information is released. But in the meantime, there's several hundred pages describing each and every education program. There's past information on the appropriations, and there's base appropriation information as well. Ms. Beckel's our expert on the budget and the accounting systems that are used for MMB, the SWIFT and other accounting systems. And so if you've got questions about that budget narrative, feel free to ask any of us, but Ms. Beckel's our absolute expert in terms of getting into the minutia of the accounting system. The second and third things we'd like to talk about today, the first of those is pupil trends, and then the second will be property taxes. If you go to your PowerPoint presentation on page 27 and 28, we want to just show you a little bit about how pupils are counted and then talk about the pupil trends. We went through yesterday how I gave you a broad view of how school funding works in Minnesota. The key to keep in mind is it's all based on the pupils served. Nearly all of the majority of the big funding formulas and nearly all the small funding formulas are based on pupil counts. And those pupil counts are what drive the funding. If you have fewer pupils, you're going to get fewer funding. If you've got more pupils, you're going to get a greater level of funding. There's some formulas that are cost-based, but really the key to keep in mind is that pupil count is going to drive everything. And again, we went through the general education printout yesterday. The very first column on there is the funding pupil units. The reason we often show things on a per pupil basis is those pupil counts can change. We'll see different numbers when the February forecast is released for the next 3 years. But even during the year, school districts' pupil counts can change, sometimes more suddenly than others. There's a whole data collection scheme at the Department of Education called the MARS system that's about collecting pupil data, and districts have several opportunities during the year to resubmit their pupil data. But one of the reasons we show things on a pupil basis is it helps local school officials know what assumptions we're using when we show revenue amounts. Those key concepts, just to remind you again, the resident pupil are all the public school kids who live within that school district boundary. The adjusted pupil count is, for all intents and purposes, a count of students served at each school. And the adjusted pupil units is weighting those secondary kids in grades 7 to 12 at 1.2. If you turn to page 39 of the presentation, you'll see a couple of charts following on enrollment. I guess if we'll start on page 40. Here's the main takeaway for you. This came out a little light in the presentation, and I apologize for that. If you start at the bottom of the graph, the very lowest line is the homeschool number. And you can see that since 1985, when the legislature has been tracking homeschool enrollment, that enrollment grew between 1985 and about 2000 at a pretty quick rate. Part of that was compliance, we think, with reporting. But basically then it was pretty level for most of the last 20 years at about slightly under 20,000 pupils that were receiving homeschool instruction. However, in the first year following the pandemic, that number spiked to about 30,000 pupils. So a really big increase in the number of homeschool pupils for that 1 year. Last year, the fall count came down by about a third to 27,000 pupils. And in another few weeks, we'll know where the non-public pupil counts are for this year and the homeschool pupil counts are. And the expectation is that number will decrease again more toward the steady state. The thick green line above that is the traditional non-public schools, and you can see that their enrollment from 1960 through 2024, that their enrollment reached its max in the mid-60s and then fell pretty dramatically to about 1972, and then has been in relatively slow decline since then. We've got about 60,000 plus non-public students in Minnesota currently. You can see at the end of that line a bit that there's a little bit of an uptick. There was a 1,000 student increase the first year after the March 2020 COVID shutdown, and a slightly bigger increase the second year. So in total, the non-public enrollment was up about 3,000, and we'll be interested to see where that number is. I think by most accounts that number is stabilizing. So most folks are guessing it's going to be in about the same place with the fall of 2022 counts. The top line, the lighter part of that line, is the combined school district and charter school enrollment. And you can see that the charter school enrollment didn't start separately until 1991 and then at a very, very small amount. But the top line is the total public school enrollment. And you can see how quickly that grew during the baby boom. From 1960 to 1972, nearly 300,000, not quite 300,000 students were added to our system. Lots of schools were built in that time frame. Tremendous crush in Minnesota schools as those kids went through the system. And then you can see a pretty sharp decline as the baby boom tailed off down to about 83 or 84. Since that time, you can see a modest increase all through the 80s up to about 2000. That was driven by two things. One, surprising to some of us, the baby boomers had children. So some of that was what they sometimes call baby bounce. There's other words for that as well. And then there was also a fair amount of in-migration to Minnesota. The in-migration came from people moving here from other countries as well as from other states, particularly in the upper Midwest. So Minnesota had about a 2% per year increase in overall student population up till about 2000. Enrollment crested then and dropped a little bit, as you can see from that top line, and then about 4 years later picked back up again. And all the way through 2020, that enrollment was increasing at a relatively slight level. And then you can see the big V-shaped drop for the first year following 2020, where that'd be the 2021 school year due to the enrollment pattern changes due to online learning and other things. So there was a significant drop in enrollment. You can see the V came back up on the other side of that, and now out into the future, you can see that the demographers and MDEs, folks who work on pupil projections, are predicting a slow decline in pupil count out into the future. So that's important for you because individual districts may vary, but since your funding is in the school finance system is based on the number of pupils, slowly declining pupil counts generally mean that it's going to take less money from you to provide the same level of funding. The line right below the green line there, that thick line, that's the charter school. That's the difference between those lines is the charter school enrollment. You can see that the charter school enrollment, and we've got some separate charts on this that separate it out a little better, has continued to grow, but the rate of growth, there's about 73,000 charter schools students now. That rate of growth is now slated to be pretty slight over the next several years and then to turn negative out into the future. Again, those numbers may change. We'll get much better estimates in February. But the key takeaway message for this committee is the enrollment declines looks like Minnesota has reached its max and is going to be in a slow decline in terms of pupils statewide. Individual districts, as I said, will vary dramatically. Some districts are going to see increasing declines in enrollment. Other districts, particularly outer ring suburbs and a few other communities, are going to continue to see pupil growth. So, Madam Chair, that's really what I wanted to say about the pupil units themselves. On page 42, I thought it might be interesting for you to see some of the demographic and other population changes in Minnesota schools over time. This chart shows in the top line the free and reduced lunch count eligibility. You can see how that grew all through the 2000s until about 2016, and then fell very dramatically in the last couple of years. We're expecting that to go way back up once we get the fall 22 data, in part because of the medical assistant matching that lets Minnesota identify more free and reduced lunch price students. So when we get that data in the next week, hopefully, or week or two, we'll be able to update that chart a bit for you. The blue line shows changes in students of color and American Indian students in Minnesota, and you can see that over the same time period, this 22-year time period, the enrollment has grown from 16 to about 35% or 36%. So a pretty significant increase. Those changes aren't necessarily uniform across districts, but statewide, the change is pretty significant. The red line, second from the bottom, the dashed red line, is special education enrollment. Special education enrollment has been growing in Minnesota. During the early 2000s, one of the biggest categories that was growing was the number of students with autism. There's been some other changes since that time as well, but that continues to be one of the faster growing categories. We have 13 categories of special education students, and we're happy to show you details over time for each of those categories for the number of students in those categories. And then finally, the bottom line is the number of students who are English learners, and you can see that that number has more than doubled over the time period as well. Those numbers are not evenly distributed in the state. As we mentioned yesterday when talking about the funding formulas, a number of communities in greater Minnesota do have large non-English speaking populations or English as a second language population, as do some of the metropolitan school districts. So Madam Chair, members, that's what I wanted to say about pupil trends. And then to finish up, we'd like to spend just a couple minutes on property taxes.
Thank you, Mr. Shum. We do have a few questions on pupil trends. So Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Strama, you pretty much answered my question right after I volunteered it, but just to the understanding when we were looking at the graph about changing student population, that what's happening is that, you know, we have a declining, just like we once had baby boomers. I'm very, very familiar with that. And how we didn't have classrooms and buildings for all the students that were out there. Right now we're having that slight adjustment where there's we can predict that there's just fewer children being born and therefore fewer children that will be arriving in our classrooms, and something we can be aware of, and it's accounted for in the per pupil formula. And you summed it up nicely, so I appreciate that.
Thank you. Representative Senator Mura.
Yeah, thank you so much, Mr. Shum, for this presentation. My question is about something that you spoke briefly about students enrolling in different districts and the district that they live in. Do we have statewide data for kind of what percentage of students take that option and then how that differs from other states? I've heard a little bit about, and I don't know if this is true, about how like Minnesota's unique laws about enrolling in different districts has led to more students choosing that option than other states, and I want to know what the data is on that. Thank you.
Yeah. Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, yes, the general organizations, there's two big ones, ECS and NCSL, that often summarize 50-state issues related to school enrollment, generally rate Minnesota very high in terms of its options for public school students. Some states have more options that involve non-public students, but for Minnesota, the public school options are toward the high end. We have a different charter school law than many states. Our charter schools are both public and independent of the school districts. In some states, they're essentially captive of the local school district. But in Minnesota, it's entirely up to the authorizers to authorize those charter schools, and their location decisions aren't dependent on public schools, things like that. We have some data tools that you might find interesting. There's one I put together each year, and I'll send the link to Mr. Kvenick to post for you all, that shows student movement by district, and you can just type in a district number, and it'll show all the schools that children who are resident to that district attend. So, for example, for your district, if you were to plug in Minneapolis, you'd see the 50,000 resident students, you'd see where those 18,000 students leave that go to charter schools and open enroll to other districts and which ones they go to. And then I think there's about 1,600 kids, between 1,000, I can't remember the number offhand, between 1,000 and 1,600, I think, that open enroll into the district as well. And you can see where the kids are coming from that open enroll into the district. So that tool's kind of a fun one to use. In terms of total enrollment movement, we have quite a bit more than many districts. In some states, the county is actually the school district authority, not the individual communities. We have sort of this organic map of 330 school districts that formed by common districts joining with each other. And often in greater Minnesota, that student enrollment can be driven by location of where the school building is. So two districts may have consolidated, but there may be a lot of people on the very eastern end of that district that are closer to the next district over. And so in greater Minnesota, that often explains a lot of the student movement. Charter schools tend to be concentrated much more heavily in the metropolitan area, so their effect is greater on metropolitan school districts. But there are a number of school districts in greater Minnesota where there is significant movement to a charter school. There's also a lot of movement to and from regional centers in greater Minnesota. Some parents very much prefer a smaller school experience, and some parents very much prefer the larger school experience that a comprehensive high school might offer. So you'll often see in mid-sized communities in greater Minnesota movement both directions. Kids coming in to go to the high school, often kids going out to smaller elementary schools in neighboring communities.
Representative Sensor Mura.
No, that's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Strauman. Why do we need databases when we have you? So with that, we will move on to an even more exciting topic. Oh, sorry, Representative Clardy. Vice Chair Clardy.
I just have a quick question regarding online enrollment. Maybe it's not a quick question, but I'm just wondering about the implications of that aspect with this data. And then my kind of a continuum, but not connected. You're projecting that the free and reduced lunches will be increasing due to new data source. Could you speak to both?
Yes.
Mr. Strong, thank you.
To the data source, the way that free and reduced lunch information is collected is either through a direct match, through data sharing by MDE and the Department of Human Services, or through the paper forms. And up until this past year, the data match was done on the basis of SNAP and MFIP eligibility primarily. MDE applied and was granted authority to match on medical assistance eligibility as well. So basically what happens is DHS goes through its files, and every family that's eligible for medical assistance at the income levels that qualify for free and reduced lunch, basically they notify MDE and DHS, have a system that transfers that data back and forth. And then school districts, when they upload and download their student data, can do the direct match. That's where the match comes from. So they have each student has an ID number. That ID number matches to particular information, and they can determine whether or not that student's eligible for free and reduced lunch through that direct match. MDE's estimates with the November forecast were that about 60,000 additional students would be identified as free and reduced lunch eligible through the medical assistance match. So that's why the forecast is predicting a big increase in compensatory revenue, and we're expecting that 60,000 students is mainly going to be on top of the existing account. Some of it may be replacing paper forms, but we'll know a lot more in a week or two when MDE has had a chance to finalize that data. In terms of your first question, there's two ways that online learning works in Minnesota. We have what's called supplemental online learning, which is where a child is enrolled in one district but may take a few classes in another district through online learning. Or we have sort of the whole enchilada version, where you can essentially enroll in an online learning program in a different district. And when you enroll in a different district for their online learning, you're actually counted in that district's enrollment. So if a Minneapolis student wanted to enroll in one of the big school districts with an online learning program is the Houston district in the southeast corner of the state. If a Minneapolis student enrolled in their online learning program full-time, they would be counted by the Houston district, not by the Minneapolis district. If, however, a student from North Branch wanted to take Russian and St. Louis Park were the only district that offered that, they could enroll through supplemental online learning to the district that's offering that course for that course. What happens then is the student stays enrolled at the district at North Branch, but that course money essentially gets transferred for that period of the day to the supplemental online learner provider. So when it's for part of the day, we call that supplemental online learning. Last year, MDE proposed clarifying the names a bit, and I imagine when we see their budget bill this year, that will be a part of it as well. One other thing that happened during the pandemic, many districts opened an online program. St. Paul, for example, opened, they had an existing program, but they opened a quite a bit bigger program that served almost 1,500 kids 2 years ago. This year, that count is way down. They were expecting that, but that count is way down. Many of the mid-sized districts that opened online learning programs have closed those programs and told their students to enroll in others that have a full-time online learning program. So we'll spend some time on this, both when we see the department's budget bill and when we talk about their language. But the online learning world was designed just a little bit before the model we're currently in. And so it doesn't flow as smoothly when you're looking at the statute as you'd like. But basically, the keys to keep in mind is if you're full-time, you're going to be enrolled in whatever district's offering that program. And if you're part-time, you're going to remain in your own district. One very last thing to say about that is the district offering the program can contract with an outside vendor for that program, provided it meets certain criteria. So some school districts do have an arrangement with, they don't do the coursework all themselves, they do have an arrangement with an online company that provides those services. There are still teacher requirements that need to be met, but there's a whole bunch of different models in the state, and we'd be glad to give you a bunch more information on that.
Representative Clardy, any follow-up?
No, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sensenmura.
Yeah, and this might be getting a little ahead of things or getting too much into the online learning, but I'm wondering, so for a student who wants to enroll in a different district than their home district, are there any, like, geographic limitations to that, or is it if I'm in Rochester, I could enroll in Mankato and there's no issue? And do we have any data about how many students or what percentage of students are doing an online option outside the district? And then last question, is there any statewide online learning program?
To the last question, Minnesota as a state does not offer its own online program, but several of the online providers, including some the Houston district and some of the charter schools, do have a statewide reach with their online programs. There's a Minnesota Transitions here in the metro area, and there's some others that have a statewide reach. But unlike some states, Minnesota doesn't have its own statewide online learning program. In terms of enrollment preferences, this applies to open enrollment and essentially to online learning. Generally speaking, the restriction in Minnesota is your local district can't keep you, but the other district doesn't have to accept you. So for open enrollment, for example, if you were from Hopkins and you wanted to go to school in Wayzata, Wayzata could say we're closed to certain grades. So Hopkins has to let you out, but Wayzata doesn't have to take you. There's a very low standard in statute for how many students. I think it's 1% that they need to let in. Many school districts are not closed to open enrollment, and some are closed for particular grades. But the key is that the resident district needs to let you out, but a non-resident district is not required, once they meet that low threshold, is not required to accept you. Usually it's space limitations for the districts that are closed. They're often districts that are bursting at the seams. And so there's
preference and things in there as well, but the short story is they don't have to take you. Same with the charter school. Charter schools use a lottery system for enrollment, but if the charter school is full, if you wanted to leave St. Paul and go to a charter school, you couldn't necessarily say, this is the charter school I'm going to. You'd have to apply through their lottery system if they're full. You're sort of around the margins when you get to those programs that are closed. There's not a whole lot that are closed to all grades. There are some, particularly in the fast-growing metro districts, that are closed.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Strom. I want to make sure we stay on time so we have time for MDE, so I want to move on, if it's okay with folks, to the property tax portion. Ms. Solve. Ms. Beckel, sorry. Not enough coffee in the world.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Strom will actually cover this as well. I am primarily here for moral support and to answer questions.
Thank you. Sorry about that, Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, members, we're cognizant of how short your time is. We would just want to make a couple really quick points for you. You're not just the committee that allocates state aid. You're going to be intently aware of the local property tax impacts that school boards make that affect their school districts and that you make regarding the levy limits. Roughly 20% of school district funding in Minnesota in total comes from the property tax. That's it can seem like, well, gee, that's only a fifth, but that's a pretty important part of school districts' revenue. It's also the revenue on the margin for them. The operating referendum and the new building revenue is at the margin and is the things you're going to hear the most about from your communities. We want to give you just a very quick overview. We'll hit these principles later. But there's two different property tax bases in Minnesota. If you go to slide 22, and this complicates your world a fair amount. There's a referendum market value tax base, and there's an adjusted net tax capacity tax base. There's a single page handout that's in your folder from yesterday that has a pie chart on the back of it. It shows this one here, that shows that the Pay 22 school district levies totaled about $3.49 billion, and it breaks it down to referendum market value and tax capacity levies, and then shows the categories in each that are voter-approved or not voter-approved. And the back side of that single sheet lists the levies by in order, so you can see there's a whole bunch of really tiny ones, a few quite large ones, and you can see that all told, about 60% of the school levies going to be on tax capacity, and about 40% is going to be on referendum market value. And in terms of voter approval, almost half of those are voter approved. So out of the $3.4 billion of school levy, almost half of those are decisions that voters in districts have made. You'll spend most of your time thinking about the big school levies, like the operating referendum levy, the local optional revenue levy, and some of the building levies. You've got small ones for things like tree growth, don't ask, swimming pools for districts that border Canada, and judgment levies for when school districts get sued. There's a lot of explanation about each of these in the school finance guidebook, but basically you've authorized about 30 levies for school districts. They go through a form each fall to determine what their maximum levy in each category is, and then the school boards in December vote to approve some or all of those levy amounts, and that becomes the certified levy amount that's spread in the following year. A couple of points to make about the tax base here. If you go to the pie charts on page 25, there's a message that I think is really important for you to keep in mind here. Your two tax bases depend entirely on decisions that happen in value and class rate changes that the Property Tax Committee makes. And these two charts tell part of that story. On the left is market value. And that's essentially, if you just took dollar for dollar the value of all the property in the state, you could see that we've got $839 billion of value in the state. Half of that's residential homesteads. Half of that's where we live in our houses. Another 14% is the rental property and other residential property. Only 14% of the market value in the state is business property, commercial, industrial property. A full 18% are ag lands, ag property, and about 4% we call the cabin seasonal rec is the property they're in. So if you look at the market value, that's who holds the value. But the legislature does two things. It applies class rates to the tax capacity system that weight different properties at different class rates, what we call legal class rates, and then there's some property that's excluded from certain K-12 taxes. So the two shares that change the most, the agricultural share, ag lands make up 18% of the value in the state, but they pay 6% of the property taxes. That's not an accident. That's a deliberate decision that the Taxes Committee and others have made at the legislature that ag lands shouldn't be carrying the burden for school taxes and other taxes. So ag land pays considerably less than its market value, and if you go to the pie slice just under that, commercial industrial property pays more than twice what its market value is. That's both because of the higher class rate that's subject to commercial industrial property is subject to, but it's also because of the statewide tax that commercial industrial property pays. You can see at the top, residential homestead pays just a slightly smaller portion than its share of market value for taxes paid, but it's still relatively close to the same place. So the key takeaway is this: the taxpayers are different in burden in terms of the market value. You use two different tax bases, referendum market value and adjusted net tax capacity. When you change one of those levies versus another, you'll have a different impact on taxpayers statewide on the property types, and different districts have different characteristics in their tax base, so some changes may be easier for some communities to absorb and harder for others. So you're always having a balancing act in this committee between levy changes and whether you'd be making those changes on referendum market value or tax capacity. Generally, you're going to leave it to the Taxes Committee to fight about where those class rates are and the statewide levy and whether that should be reduced or not. But those still affect the way that school levies are calculated and spread, and that's really important for you. Last word on this, just to show you remember that about 20% of school funding comes from the property tax, but if you look at the taxes paid to each type of government, you can see for payable in 2022, that out of that $11.7 billion that's paid, school districts are very close to the largest share. Counties are slightly larger, 31% statewide of all the property taxes paid go to counties, 29% go to school districts, about 25% to cities, and then the statewide tax that comes into the state general fund is about 7% of the total. You can see townships collect about 2.5% of the statewide property tax, special taxing jurisdictions about 4%, and at the very bottom on the right, the initials TIF will send our chair into delirium. That stands for tax increment financing, and the Taxes Committee rips out their hair each year in trying to decide how to deal with TIF districts. But essentially what happens there is a portion of the tax base is captured away from the regular recipients of that money, and that can lead to a lot of controversy. I think, Madam Chair, I think you have a whole article in your taxes bill each year that deal with TIF districts. So, I know you're short on time, so I want to just wrap it up there if there are any last-minute questions, but otherwise we can get over to MDE.
Thank you, Mr. Strom, and I did not mean to cut you too short. Could you quickly explain, I know there's about 30 different levies that school boards can do on their own, but can you highlight the few that have to go to the voters and maybe briefly touch on equalization, because I know that's another issue that we always fight with: who's going to cover that in their budget, whether or not it be the tax committee, because it's really direct tax cuts for people versus into the classroom, but sometimes we have it in our budget as well. So maybe just the few that go to the voters and briefly explain equalization.
Yeah. Madam Chair, members, on the two-page handout that you've got, and if folks need a different copy of this, we'll quick send. Our page can go make 30 extra copies if this one was hard to find in the folders. There's the pie chart on the front side, and on the back side, there's a list in order of each of those levy categories, and the last question there is an election required? And as you look down there, you can see that there's about five where elections are required. That's for the voter-approved operating referendum, for the capital projects referendums, for the debt service referendum, and for if a district were to issue bonds for the OPEB pension debt, which districts do not do through voter approval because it would be, well, we will get into that later. But basically there's a few categories that require the elections, but the big three you need to think about: operating referendum when your district is asking for more money for general operating purposes. The second category, facilities needs through bond sales. And then the third category, a district can have a capital projects referendum for up to 10 years. That's voter approved, and that's often for technology purposes for the school district. So those are the three primary ones that require elections. You can see on the top that that makes up 47%. Just those three levy categories make up 47% of the total levy authority that districts have. All the rest of the levies listed on this page, those are all at school board discretion, although most school boards would tell you they're pretty much mandatory because they're going to lose revenue if they don't levy the whole amount. So out of all that levy that's certified each year, usually it's within a percent or two of the total levy limit, the total amount possible for school districts. So we tend to refer to that as school districts are levying to the max. Their certification is right at the maximum. In terms of equalization, the second column to last column on this sheet shows those ones that are equalized. A fair number of the school levies are equalized. And in brief, what equalization means is that the aid levy mix is determined by the relative tax base per pupil in the school district. The lower your tax base, the higher your state aid. The higher your tax base per pupil, the lower your state aid. And the idea is to bring tax base fairness, essentially rate fairness, across school districts that may have very different kinds of tax bases. Equalization costs money if you're going to increase the equalization, but what you're buying with that is lower property taxes. So often the taxes committee and the K-12 committee are wanting the other committee to spend part of their target on providing additional equalization aid. In general, in the theory of school finance, high levels of equalization are a really good thing because they mean low property value districts have the same opportunities and chances as high property value districts. Madam Chair, we can spend a great deal of time on equalization, and I'd be happy to put some charts together and some examples together for the committee so they can think
maybe
about
it. Maybe
we works.
Will gauge the rest of the committee's interest before we do that. I know where my interest is, but last question, too, and it kind of goes towards maybe what Representative West was asking earlier. It has always been my assumption, which I've learned quickly, that you should never assume, but you ask the experts, that about 85% of a district's budget is really state aid or general fund, and the rest can be operating levy or things that are coming for those excess levies. I've always felt like the general fund and what we provide is kind of the cake, and the levies were supposed to be the icing, but sometimes when we don't fund the cake batter, things shrink for everybody. But can you maybe touch on those percentages that just so we kind of have that in our heads?
Yeah, for the operating percentage, about 6% of a school district's total revenue for operating revenue is from those voter-approved levies. So remember from the printout the other day, that was about $900 per pupil of operating referendum revenue. Our 1 to a million calculation we talked about yesterday means about $900 million is in that category. So 6% of the total is basically in that category. And then, you know, I think there's sort of two kinds of cake icing for you, and districts might argue that that's all being used for the necessities. But the other is on the facility side. Districts obviously need facilities, but district facility, their physical plans look very different from district to district. Part of that is growth cycle based. Part of that is what voters are willing to approve in those districts. Part of that is based on their tax bases. So we'll see some communities even right next to each other where one school district has a very substantial physical plant. Another may be stuffed to the brim and has had trouble passing money for a new elementary school. Sometimes that's tax-based related. Sometimes that's related to feelings in the community about where the school is located or what the projects are going to include. The other thing that's important to note is school districts that have a lot of building debt often have trouble passing their operating referendum because the voters are already paying a lot for the buildings. And one example that I'm sure all of you will hear from, even if you don't represent the district, is the St. Michael Albertville School District. They have a very nice physical plant. They have a lot of growth that they've had to accommodate, They have a very big physical plant, and they can't pass an operating referendum to save their lives to provide additional operating money. So whether that's equalization related, whether that's the feeling of the voters, or whether it's the tax burden that folks are feeling because of the cycle where they're at in terms of their buildings, those are all related. But I'm sure all of you with your school districts have your own story about what's happened in your community and whether your operating referendum's been related to your debt needs and vice versa. It tends to all be a big ball, and there's different ways that's approached, and oftentimes there's a long history. Folks may be mad where a school was closed many years ago. They may be mad where a new school is intended to be built. So there's just a lot of reasons why that's the case. But in answer to your questions, about 6% for the operating referendum and about 11% of the total for the facilities.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. I believe we're going to move on to MDE, is because I don't think I've seen anybody raise their hands for questions. So why don't we do that transition now and have folks. Thank you, Mr. Strom, Ms. Beckel, so much. And folks, realize that you can always, always go to them with questions. And as we're making the transitions, I know you guys have a lot to overview. We heard some of it in education policy, but we'd like to be done with your presentation, if possible, around 11:50 so that we can have time for questions. We may take a few brief questions in between chunks if people feel like they need to get the question out right away, but I want MDE to be able to finish today. Was a quick transition. Thank you so much, members. We have Minnesota Department of Education in front of us today. These are folks that we will be working with throughout session as we craft our legislation, and they are also very accessible. And I'm happy to welcome our new MDE commissioner to the table as well, and I think we will dive right in and have the commissioner introduce himself.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the House Education Finance Committee. My name is Willie Jett, and I would like to thank you for the opportunity to be here today to introduce myself as the new Commissioner of Education for the state of Minnesota. First, I'd like to tell you just a little bit about myself before our team provides you an overview of the great work we do at the Minnesota Department of Education. And I'm going to pause here because I need to apologize because some of you may have heard this presentation or had heard me or a little bit about me yesterday. So with that, education, it's at my core. It's at the core of who I am. I come from a family of educators. I was born and raised in Minnesota, and I'm a product of the Osseo schools. After receiving my higher education in Maryland, Illinois, New York, and Pennsylvania, I came back, as many of us do, to be with my family and to answer my calling in education. I've taught and coached basketball in several districts, including Anoka Hennepin, Osseo, and Minneapolis. After earning my administrative licensure through the University of Minnesota, I served as an assistant principal in Osseo, principal at Hopkins High School, assistant superintendent at St. Paul Public Schools, and most recently as superintendent of St. Cloud Area School District for the last 9 years. My background, education, and professional experience have all led me to this role, this moment, to serve as the Commissioner of Education. I understand the unique challenges facing communities in the metro and communities in greater Minnesota. I have the perspective of a student, parent, teacher, coach, and administrator. I know firsthand the complexities of diversity in our schools. So I come here today with the perspective of a lifetime of work in education, with the commitment to work with each and every one of you to provide the opportunities for all of our students, regardless of race or zip code, to help them meet their full potential that they so richly deserve. I'm excited to continue work on carrying out Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan's Due North Education Plan. Next slide, please. It is also important for this committee and its members, many of you new to your positions, just like me, to understand what the Minnesota Department of Education is and who the people are that work there. First, we are all guided by Minnesota's 10 commitments to equity. Each and every one of these guiding principles for our team members is focused on the most important part of the puzzle, our students, and providing the inputs to give them the best opportunities to achieve their full potential. Next slide, please. So under Governor Walz's and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan's One Minnesota Vision, we are striving to make Minnesota the best state in the country for children to grow up, regardless of who they are or what their background is. Our MDE employees are dedicated to this. Next slide, please. Briefly, with roughly 400 staff, the department serves over 870,000 pre-kindergarten through 12th grade students in over 2,200 schools. We also work in a system with almost 57,000 teachers. Our work touches everything from adult basic education to libraries to special education to getting funding out the door. All things you will hear about from the MDE leadership team. Next slide, please. Each student brings a uniqueness with them into the education space. While all of those unique individual characteristics cannot be captured in high-level data, I think it's important to reflect who is showing up in our schools each and every day for some of you today. Our student population is racially and ethnically diverse. Around 37% of our students are of color or American Indian. 11.6% are Black. 10.5% are Latinx. 6.9% are Asian. 6% identify as two or more races. 1.7% are American Indian or Alaska Native. And 0.1% are Native Hawaiian or Pacific Islander. Nearly 10% of our students are English language learners. Over 15% receive special education services. And more than 30% are eligible for free and reduced price lunch. Being able to serve each and every one of these students is why we structure our supports and services the way that we do. Next slide, please. The services and supports that our divisions provide to different sectors or areas of the public education system all have common threads. We consistently partner with and support school districts, charter schools, intermediate districts, service cooperatives, and special education districts. We develop tools and resources for students, educators, administrators, families, and community members. We regularly create and develop professional development for our educators. And as mentioned, we distribute funding to schools and provide grant opportunities to a range of partners. We also put out in-depth analysis of programs and educational outcomes for educators and decision makers. We also provide accountability, regulatory, and implementing roles across the education statutes and rules. Next slide, please. This is an organizational chart for your convenience. Our leadership team will discuss the work that each of these divisions does. Now, this may seem like a lot, but we believe it will be of great value for members of this committee to see the breadth of our work and how our dedicated professionals support our students, educators, parents, schools, and communities each and every day. And with that, I am proud to welcome my colleagues, Deputy Commissioner Stephanie Barrage, Assistant Commissioners Bobby Burnham, Stephanie Graff, Darren Cordy, and Chief Financial Officer Denise Anderson. I will now pass it on to Deputy Commissioner Barrage, unless there are some specific questions for me.
Well, first, Commissioner, I just want to thank you for being here today. And I myself and our family appreciated your time in Hopkins. So thank you. And thank you. Members, do you have any brief questions for the Commissioner before we move on? Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. Good to see you again.
Good to see you too.
Just wondering if the governor, you and the governor have kind of a set of priorities you could share with us, that maybe some common priorities like reading scores, addressing learning loss, that kind of thing. Are there some priorities you can think of that I just would love to find some common ground so we can all work together to, you know, get some place and if you have some, and maybe addressing the achievement gap or that kind of thing.
So, Madam Chair and members of the committee, in having conversation with the governor and lieutenant governor, first and foremost, people have that conversation or that question about, with the pandemic, learning loss. And one of the things that we've looked at is it's a unique opportunity. And so foundationally, what we're concentrating on is, I'm not going to say the three R's, but it's the reading, writing. So literacy, math, science, social studies. That's at the crux of what we're trying to get to. We've had students during that time who accelerated during the pandemic. We've had students who struggled during the pandemic. And so at this point in time, we're trying to make sure that we provide best practices for each for across that entire spectrum. But we're definitely concentrating on language arts or the literacy, math, science, and social studies.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. And thank you, Commissioner. I think that's great. And we share those priorities. So look forward to working with you and the governor on those things.
Thank you.
Thank you. And did we want to turn to Deputy Commissioner Barrage?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the record, my name is Deputy Commissioner Stephanie Barrage. Who are we and what do we do? You will hear from my colleagues. We will have I will share around the Office of American Indian Education that Dr. Jane Hartstead leads with Melanie Franks, the Office of the Deputy Commissioner, which is my office, and then the Office of External Relations, Chief of Staff Wendy Hatch. We will have the Office of Teaching and Learning, Assistant Commissioner Bobby Burnham, Educational Opportunities, Stephanie Graff, Student Support Services, Darren Corti, and Office of Chief Financial Officer, Denise Anderson. Next slide. The Office of American of Indian Education works to strengthen and promote positive experiences and educational outcomes for American Indian students statewide. The vision statement of the American Indian Education Office is that all American Indian students will reach their full potential within their school communities through meaningful, equitable, and targeted educational experiences that affirms and values their unique cultural identities. We value language, we value culture, and the significant and complex history of Indigenous people, the input of Minnesota's tribal nations and communities, the perspective of parents and students, the gifts and unique cultural needs of American Indian students, and effective and innovative programming options. What I really would like for you to note is that the last time that we presented, we have doubled staff in this office. We were at 3, now we are at 6. As well as the districts that we have served, we moved from 211 to 229 since the last update. Next slide. Under the Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion Center, which is next in public engagement, and the human resources fall under my office. Next slide. Thank you. We provide our work out of the EDI Center is the foundational and ongoing professional learning to agency staff, specialized professional learning for leadership. We lead and manage affirmative action responsibilities, goals, and objectives. We partner with the Human Resources Department to craft and implement diversity and inclusion initiatives and activities. We provide equity, diversity, and inclusion foundational and ongoing professional learning to districts, schools, charters, and community groups to help operationalize equity, diversity, and inclusion and anti-racist principles and strategies. We partner with LEAs, community groups, and organizations to create programs and supports that grow racial equity leaders, identify educational inequities, and provide technical support, train and offer equity reviews to LEAs and community groups and organizations. We also work within the School Climate Center. It helps schools and community members develop safe and supportive learning environments to reduce bullying, harassment, and other, and I'm just going to say it, mean-spirited behavior. We are established by the Safe and Supportive Minnesota School Act, Minnesota's Bullying Prevention and Intervention Law. The center provides resources, training, and technical assistance to schools, students, and families in creating safe and supportive school communities. The center provides services for the following topics: bullying and harassment, school climate improvement, restorative practices, social and emotional learning, discipline policies and procedures and practices, comprehensive school and mental health, school safety, inclusive school practices. The center school has been awarded $2.9 million to the School Climate Transformation Grant from the U.S. Department of Education to increase the center's capacity to support Minnesota schools as they implement multi-tiered system behavior framework for
for improving behavioral outcomes and improve school climate for students throughout the center and throughout the state. The center was recently awarded a 5-year Project Aware grant supporting mental health services for students statewide and in three Minnesota district partners. Next slide. Our public engagement department supports and facilitates direct outreach and engagement with students, families, and the broader communities throughout our state. Next slide. And the Office of External Relations services the entire agency in communicating to the public. Thank you, and I'm going to pass it to my colleague, Assistant Commissioner Burnham.
Madam Chair, committee members, thanks for having us here this morning. My name is Bobby Burnham, and I serve as the Assistant Commissioner for the Office of Teaching and Learning. And within the Office of Teaching and Learning, we have the divisions of Early Learning Services, Academic Standards Assessment and Instruction, State Library Services, and Out-of-School Time. And the recently new units for Compass in Minnesota Multi-Tiered Systems of Support and our Literacy Unit. Those units were created as a response to COVID, and they have been very active and effective, and we are continuing to do the work with schools around the implementation of those teams. Next slide. In the Division of Early Learning Services, as most of our work at the Department of Ed, it focuses on a set of core academic standards. And in early learning, those are called the Minnesota Early Childhood Indicators of Progress. And those standards guide the work of these following programs: the Health and Developmental Screening Program, the School Readiness Program, and the Early Childhood Family Education Program, all administered through Community Ed and Fund 4. We have Head Start and Early Head Start, and Minnesota is one of a handful of states that are very fortunate to have a state allocation to support our most at-risk kids through Head Start programming. We have our voluntary pre-K and our School Readiness Plus, which currently serves 7,160 four-year-olds. We have Early Childhood Special Education, which is our Part C and our Part B programming. And we have the Early Learning Scholarship Program, as well as multiple activities currently going on through our Preschool Development Grant. We just received notification that we have yet received another round of Preschool Development Grant funds. And we are focusing with this particular last round of grant, federal grant money, on the development of a mixed delivery system, as well as addressing our early childhood workforce issues. Next slide. In the Division of Academic Standards, Instruction, and Assessment, this division provides content, area expertise, and support for K-12 students throughout Minnesota, guiding, identifying, and implementing the academic standards. Staff also leads a comprehensive and collaborative effort to review, revise, and implement the state's high academic standards in arts, English language arts, social studies, math, and physical education. These standard revision processes include experts and practitioners to review standards, holding engagement meetings, and developing a written report outlining the work that identifies how the statute was carried out throughout the process. The staff also provides training, professional guidance, and assistance to help teachers across the state unpack standards and implement the standards and improve classroom instruction. There are also several federal and state legislatively named grants that this division administers, as well as our statewide assessment system. Next slide, please. We also have a division that includes the State Library Services and the Expanded Learning Opportunities team. So the State Library programs and that staff really administer several library-related federal and state grants, including the Regional Library Basic System Support the telecommunications aid, the multi-county type aid, and the library construction grants, as well as arts and cultural heritage funds for libraries and the Electronic Library for Minnesota, as well as the Minnesota Braille and Talking Book Library. Also, federal library programs are distributed through this division, and they support federal grant opportunities for services like interlibrary loan, Braille and Talking Book Library, and other innovative library programming at schools, public and academic local libraries, an initiative to increase equity, diversity, and inclusion in all public libraries and school libraries. The out-of-school time team administers the 21st Century Federal Grant Program, as well as the at-risk after-school meal program and the ARPA summer and after-school opportunities. Next slide, please. The Minnesota Multi-Tiered System of Support is a framework to guide and support continuous improvement in districts and schools. You can see the four core elements described, and these are elements that are effective in any that are needed in any education system designed to ensure social, emotional, behavior, developmental, and academic outcomes for all students. Compass is the delivery system for MTSS. Compass provides support for schools in the areas of literacy, math, and social emotional learning and mental health through this multi-tiered systems of support. So when asked around how the department is addressing not only the learning loss, but the overall continuous improvement and the overall achievement gap in Minnesota, these are really core programs that help address those gaps. Next slide, please. Which brings us to the work of the literacy team. So I think we can all agree that Minnesota needs to make some drastic shifts in how we support schools in reading best practices, making sure school leaders are better informed about best practices, having a deeper partnership with our institutions of higher ed to ensure our teacher candidates come out with these instructional best practices. So Minnesota Bold is a birth through grade 12 action plan for literacy achievement, and it's really a roadmap for how Minnesota is going to make some big transitions over the next 3 to 4 years and have better outcomes by 2027, if not sooner. MTSS is a support of the Bold Literacy Plan, and it's based in the science of reading and the Compass Literacy Pathway. So our goal of the Bold Plan is to increase access to effective literacy experiences for all students, with a focus on those most underserved, by ensuring school leaders, educators, and educators are trained in the science of reading, utilize data literacy to inform instruction, educator development, resource deployment and policy, and employ intentional family and community engagement strategies. We are in ongoing conversations with our partners at Pelsby to talk with them about processes and guidelines that we can put in place to ensure that the relicensure process, as well as the course approval process for institutions of higher ed, are inclusive of these best practices based in the science of reading. This division also oversees a federal CLSD grant that focuses on a coaching model, and currently those schools that have this federal grant are really making that shift to be trained in practices in the science of reading. And then, as you all know, we received $3 million last year from the legislature, and they named Letters, which is a particular training program in the science of reading. It's certainly not the only training program, but it was named, and therefore we took the $3 million happily, and are training 2,300 teachers in letters, which is a pretty comprehensive 18-month training program in the science of reading. And then we, of course, have the dyslexia, a specialist at MDE, and I'm keeping her very, very busy. And she is supporting efforts in those areas around the screening data collection, as well as partnering. She is part of our literacy unit and is working on the Read Well by Third Grade legislative requirements. And that, Madam Chair, is the work of the Office of Teaching and Learning.
Thank you, Deputy Assistant Commissioner Burnham. Did you want to make the transition now to the rest of the team? As you're getting settled, just a quick reminder to make sure that you state your name for the record, and then you can proceed with who's ever going to go first.
Great. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephanie Graff. I'm an assistant commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Education, and I'll take a few moments just to talk through a little bit of the work of the Office of Educational Opportunity that I have the privilege of working with. First, we have our Student Access and Opportunity Division. This division is led by Dr. Teresa Taylor. Then we have our Career and College Success Division, led by Director Sally Reynolds. We have our School and Educator Support Division, led by Director Greg Keith. And we have our Data Practices and Analytics Division, led by Dr. Lisa Burton. The Student Access and Opportunity Division really provides leadership for state and federal programs for schools and districts across the state of Minnesota. The division and the team really focuses on providing equity-focused funding streams. For example, a large share of the funding that this division oversees is related to federal title funds. So these are specific funding streams for some of our most at-risk students across the state, including students experiencing homelessness, migrant students, and students that are English learners, just to name a few. The division also provides resources for non-public schools, commonly known as equitable share in federal law, so that we're providing opportunities for students in non-public schools as well, and really focuses on the oversight with compliance for both state and federal rules and regulations through the work of the division. Some of the state programs that this team leads and guides is related to the World's Best Workforce, Multilingual Learner Education under the Learning English for Academic Proficiency and Success, or LEAPS Act, World Language Education, EL programming driven by state resources, and community engagement on the implementation of LEAPS as well. The majority of the division really focuses on, as I mentioned, federal programs. So this includes the oversight, implementation, and assistance for 8 large federal title programs, including Title I, Title II, Title III, Title IV, and Title V. It also includes work around the Every Student Succeeds Act, or ESSA, accountability and federal reporting requirements, as well as the team supports the federal COVID stimulus education funding, including the ESSER funds and the GEAR funds. Specifically within this division, much of the oversight for the flow-through funding of our federal COVID stimulus dollars that went straight out to school districts across the state. The Career and College Success Division really is focused on ensuring every learner is prepared for post-high school. That could be post-secondary, it could be further training, it could be the military or career. Some of the kind of units or teams within this division are listed on the slide. Starting with career and technical education, nearly every high school across the state provides some form of technical career and technical education for students. This team includes a team of fantastic content experts and specialists that are supporting the development and implementation of career and technical education programming across the state. And so these are experts in things like agriculture, food and natural resources, business and marketing, trade and industry, right, and some of those core kind of career clusters and CTE content areas that really work alongside our school communities to provide CTE opportunities for students. They also focus on work-based learning opportunities, including experiential learning, building partnership with industry and business between school communities and local businesses, apprenticeships, internships, and a lot of career development-focused efforts. The division also leads high school initiatives really focused on transition to post-secondary for students. This includes alternative learning across the state, access to dual coursework options, so this could be advanced placement, IB, concurrent enrollment or post-secondary or enrollment options or PSEO, making sure that students have opportunity for access to receive credit in high school as well as credit in college at the same time. Online learning programs, as well as the Minnesota Career Information System, which is an online career exploration system for students across the state. And then adult basic education, and we have about 300 adult basic education or ABE delivery sites across the state, serving about 65,000 adult learners on an annual basis. About half of these adult learners are enrolled in English language learning programs. So much of the work within ABE is focused on adult literacy instruction, also providing adult secondary credential options. So this includes high school equivalency credentials like the GED or the HISET, as well as adult career pathway programming, making sure that there's that intentional connection to employment opportunities across the state. The School and Educator Support Division leads efforts to build capacity and support leaders and teachers, really grounded in continuous improvement processes to support student learning. And then also making sure that we are building the very best, most talented, and diverse workforce that we can across the state for our students. Much of the work around school improvement is very connected to the Compass and MTSS efforts that Assistant Commissioner Bobby Burnham just talked through. But this team supports the schools that are identified under the Federal Every Student Succeeds Act for improvement, working closely with the regional centers of excellence. This team also leads full-service community school grants and state support, really as we think about full-service community schools being hubs for wraparound supports for students and families. Family engagement supports, English learner programming supports, as well as work called MEARS related to dropout prevention and early identification and intervention for students. The regional centers of excellence are located in 6 regional service cooperatives across the state. This is a partnership between MDE and the service cooperatives that provides direct support to our school districts in every corner of the state, particularly those that are identified under the federal ESSA law. Also includes some state resources that are able to provide things like principal leadership supports, school climate specialists working closely with Dr. Barrage's EDI Center, as well as equity specialists across the state. The Educator Effectiveness Unit really, as I mentioned, is focused on building the best, most talented, and diverse workforce that we can for our students. They lead the QComp program. It's been in place since 2005. It's a program focused on professional development, mentorship, leadership opportunities for teachers, as well as teacher performance pay. Only some districts are able to participate in QComp, but all districts are required to have teacher and principal development and evaluation systems. And so this team provides resources, training, example models, and networking for our schools across the state. Equitable access to diverse and effective educators. So work to make sure that we are moving forward with ensuring that our students see themselves and the teachers that are sitting in front of them every day, and that our teachers reflect the diverse student population that we serve across the state. So things like Grow Your Own models, teacher mentorship programs, other efforts to diversify the workforce that have come out of this body for MDE to lead on. And then school leader coaching and support. And so I sort of mentioned that through the regional centers as well, but really thinking about best practice around instructional leadership for our school leaders, both in charter schools as well as public schools across the state. Lastly, out of my office, the Data Practices and Analytics Division really builds consistent capacity for appropriate data use. This is a small but mighty team. They support both internal and external data use, help with efforts around data literacy in partnership with the Compass team, and really thinking about how we use high-quality data to drive our decisions on behalf of our students and our families. Some of the specific work of the division is around data collection and systems, so things like the Discipline Incident Reporting System, the Minnesota Common Core Catalog, statewide longitudinal education data, as well as the Minnesota Student Survey are collected by this team. Work around data analysis to, like I said, answer key questions to drive decisions, support for internal and external data requests that we receive at MDE, and a lot of support to meet state and federal requirements related to data transparency and data reporting, including the data center on the MDE website, as well as the Minnesota report card. data practices and governance are done in partnership with our Office of General Counsel. And then a technology modernization project also done with Minit, really thinking about how we change the way and transform the way that student-level data are collected, managed, and reporting across the state. I'll turn it over to Assistant Commissioner Darren Cordy.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner Graff. Assistant Commissioner Cordy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Darren Cordy. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for the Office of Student Support Services at MDE. In that role, I oversee five divisions, which you can see listed there. In the interest of time, I won't read them. But our first is the Assistance and Compliance Division. This division has four units. The first is our Special Education Program Monitoring Team, which is a front-end compliance mechanism for the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, as well as state special education statutes and rules to basically ensure that school policies and procedures are in alignment with those federal and state laws and that we're catching any possible violations of those laws before it results in a conflict between families and the school districts or charter schools. We also provide special education fiscal monitoring, which is a check to ensure that all expenditures that are occurring using state and federal special education dollars are allowable uses of those dollars, and we use a continuous improvement monitoring process to identify districts that may be at risk for having unallowable expenditures and, of course, having to pay that money back. We also have the special education due process and dispute resolution team. This is more of the back-end compliance measure, where if we have a family that has a dispute with a school district or charter school about the services that they believe their child is entitled to, they can come to us, and we offer facilitated IEP team meetings, mediation, complaints investigations, and hearing systems to help resolve those conflicts. They also facilitate the State Restrictive Procedures Work Group, which is a work group that was gathered under the state's Olmstead Plan with the goal of reducing the use of restrictive procedures in classrooms as well as eliminating the use of seclusion for students with disabilities. And then lastly, we have our Student Maltreatment Program, which investigates allegations of abuse, neglect, or sexual abuse at the hands of school staff, of students, abuse of students and school staff, by staff and bus drivers that occurs in Minnesota public schools or charter schools. Our next team is our Nutrition Program Services team. They administer a number of USDA and state-based programs, the first of which is the National School Lunch Program and the National School Breakfast Program, which is your traditional school lunch and breakfast programs that you all are probably pretty familiar with. We also administer some community nutrition programs that provide payments for meals and snacks at child care centers, daycare centers, after school care centers, and emergency care centers, as well as funding for schools and nonprofit organizations that serve meals and snacks during the summer when school is not in session. We have a summer food service program that serves meals to all students 18 and under when school is not in session. There's also a food distribution program where USDA utilizes their economy of scale and mass purchasing power to procure commodities at a lower price than what school districts could normally purchase things at. We at MDE coordinate the ordering and distribution process of those food commodities. Then there's also a couple of milk programs that we administer around providing cash reimbursement for milk that is provided at low or no cost to families in Minnesota. Next, we have the Special Education Division. Again, in the interest of time, I won't go through each of these programs, but these are the programs that that division administers and would be happy to talk about any of those in detail at a later time. But really, the guiding principles of this division is to support the whole child, recognizing the uniqueness of each child, collaborating with our partners, and promoting and measuring evidence-based outcomes. We also have a charter center at the Minnesota Department of Education. The charter center helps provide leadership, training, and support to help promote high-quality charter schools and authorizer excellence in Minnesota. They conduct evaluation and approval processes for opening new charter schools, expanding existing charter schools to new grade levels, or replicating or expanding existing charter schools to new sites. Lastly, I have the Office of the General Counsel. This is a relatively new office within MDE, but this office provides in-house legal counsel to the commissioner, the cabinet, and the staff. They are the primary liaison with the Attorney General's office when it comes to litigation that the agency may be involved in. As Assistant Commissioner Graff mentioned, we work closely with the data practices team to fulfill data requests that come in from the public, the legislature, and the press. And then we also assist with administrative rulemaking. We don't do a lot of rulemaking at MDE, but when we do, this office helps assist navigating the complexities of the Administrative Procedures Act. So with that, I'll hand it over to my colleague, our CFO, Denise Anderson.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner Cordy. And next up, go ahead and state your name for the record.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Denise Anderson, and I serve as the Chief Financial Officer at the Department of Education. In the interest of time, I'm just going to briefly highlight a couple of areas in the divisions that I oversee. In the School Finance Division, they're the group of people that administer the state's school finance system. One of the critical activities in that division is they process the state aid payments that go out to districts and charters and other education entities twice a month. They also provide information and support to state policymakers through modeling funding proposals, staffing work groups, testifying at the legislature, and they coordinate approximately 100 fiscal notes on school finance legislation each session. They prepare the November and February state forecasts, so in the very near future we'll be working with Tim and other nonpartisan staff on the February forecast information. That'll be coming out then in February. There's also a small team of people in this division that performs financial audits of at least 25 school districts and charter schools on an annual basis. They provide technical assistance to schools on financial reporting, cash flow management. And then another key area in the school finance division is the school facilities work, where they review the construction projects that school districts submit, and they also review charter school lease agreements for charter school lease aid. Another division that I oversee in the department is our agency finance division. This division works in partnership with all of the program areas that you've heard about today to support the work of the department. I think of these activities as important, but they're the back office activities like procurement, contracts, grants, financial reporting, and budgeting. As a part of that, we also have a risk mitigation, a very, very small unit for risk mitigation and internal controls. So on an annual basis, the department reviews approximately 100 control objectives, and we evaluate our performance and look for areas of improvement. We do some risk assessment planning and risk mitigation activities, and then continuity of operations planning as well. And then lastly, I'll just mention that I am the liaison then to our Minute at MDE folks. Minute is actually a separate agency, but they have staff assigned at each of the agencies. And so I liaison with that group of people. We partner together on our IT priorities and infrastructure activities for the year. And so this last slide here just identifies some of our priorities for this fiscal year. So, and with that, I will say thank you.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner. Members, I really do appreciate that you sped up your presentation. I know there's a lot of information in there. Members know that they can always approach these folks offline as well, but we do have about 5 minutes for questions. So, Representative Senator Mura.
Yeah, so my question is about the letters, which I know was a topic of discussion last legislative session. I have some constituents who are really concerned about the inclusion of that specific program by the legislature last year. So I'm wondering if you can just explain a little bit more about kind of what the process was for choosing letters and kind of talk about, is it practice for the state to designate a program for teacher professional development? And then also, can you talk a little bit about the amount of time that it takes to train teachers in that program and kind of how the state is thinking about that? Thank you.
Thank you. Assistant Commissioner Burnham.
Madam Chair, thank you. That's a great question. So Letters was, like I mentioned, a legislatively named program. So we didn't choose it. It was chosen for us. And so we had, we were directed to contract with the vendor and implement that money into Letters training. As a state agency, we will not name one training program over another. We are working on a menu of training options to offer school districts and school leaders. Letters will certainly be on that list because it is a very widely used training across the nation. It is pretty extensive. It's 18 months of training, and it's level one and level two, and it's mostly asynchronous, but there are requirements to meet as a professional learning community with the coaches and facilitators from Voyager Sopris, which is the company that implements Letters. So we welcome the opportunity to get those 2,300 teachers trained, but we know that there are other programs that will be as effective, and we hope to offer a menu of options to get early career, mid-career, late career teachers, make this training available to them where it's a little more available in knowing how busy they are and the time frame and the cost. So we are all working on that menu as we speak.
Thank you. We have about 2 minutes left, so I'm going to go to Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is in regards to Letters, so I'm glad we don't have to...
Oh, I'm pausing myself. Thank you. Rookie mistake. All right, my question is in regards to Letters as well. You talked about 2,300 teachers have been trained or are in the
or
process
trained.
Of being trained. Can you talk about where, kind of the breakdown of where those teachers are generally geographically?
Assistant Commissioner.
Madam Chair, that's a great question, and I would love to provide that data. It is statewide. We tried to recruit in all regions of the state, but I will get a more detailed breakout of how many teachers in part of the problem is Voyager Sopris owns that data, and these are licenses, so we're having conversations with them about getting that data, because I would love to know, even beyond these 2,300 teachers, what districts in Minnesota are providing training in the science of reading, whether it be Letters or other options. But Letters certainly is the training option you will hear most about.
Thank you, Representative Baker. One quick more. Is it one that you could take offline?
Yep.
I wanted to give Representative Perez Vega one quick question, and then we really do have to adjourn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I want to, was the number of letter instructed teachers, was it 2,500 or 2,800 that was funded for?
Madam Chair, it's 2,300 currently 2,300. Okay. Being trained with that legislative allocation from last session.
Got it. Thank you.
Thank you.
And there's some administrators in there as well.
Oh, Representative Bennett, did you have?
Madam Chair, just a quick question for you if we're done with this part from Rep. Crisha, who had to leave for a meeting. He's just wondering what the projected plan is for next week, if you know it, and what bills might be expected.
I am trying to get on Rep. Crisha's schedule so that we can actually talk about that in person.
That would be
But tomorrow we have an overview of nutrition and PELT from our Professional Educator Licensing and Standard Board. We're still working on next week's schedule, so have Rep. Crisha text me. Thank you. With that, we're adjourned.